believe in television. I did believe in us. In the year of 1990, a dwarf did a dance and whispered to Agent Cooper, "Language is dead." A signal reroutes signal to the signifier. Suddenly, the ghost of Truman Capote appears in silk slippers, saying, "Television is so absorbing." A network reroutes signal to the signifier. Fuck the world outside. We are the Alpha and the Omega. Let's have a television program that has television celebrities answering questions on TV programs. Can the continuity announcer answer the question put by the sports anchorman? Well, I'm glad you asked me that, Doug. Well, Mike, I'm glad you're glad. Watch the real drama in the ads. Watch the couple exploring their passion with Flash, liquid detergent, does it in half the time. Saturday evening with your host, Ryan Turd. Fabulous first friends, don't go away. Housemates, Taryn talks to Jeff about Rick. Pete eventually comes out of the bathroom. Will they vote to be head traitor? Later on that same network, a signal reroutes. A bodybuilder on the toning machine reroutes the signal to the signifier. Laura Palmer will rise from the grave and the dwarf will switch off Agent Cooper. That poem was called To New Television. It's one of my favourite topics, postmodernism and television. Anyway, hello everybody, and greetings from Galway, and I'd like to thank Jean and Paul for having me here. And that poem, obviously, I'd done there was a performance piece, and performance poetry is a hot button topic in Galway. And I would do a number of, you know, conventional pieces, and with one or two more performance pieces. I'm going to start off with, I suppose, a seasonal medley, in the broadest sense, with a poem, let's say, that's related to spring, summer, and autumn. Now, this is in the very broadest sense. The first poem I'm going to read is called Roundabout. And I noticed that you actually had traffic here, too, in Cork. Because we have quite a lot of them in Galway as well. And this poem is called Roundabout. Early spring. It's 6:30 in the evening. The sky fluctuates from yellow to blue. 100 smoked headlights inch their way in on the main road. In that moment they achieve unity to become a smiling bloated insect with 100 laughing eyes, 100 asinine jingles. The emergent insect knows all about the hand that feeds, the butter and the bread. Carrying 100 deep lakes of perpetual gratitude, it turns west at the roundabout and hysterically reaches for the pragmatic little fist. Fifth spring. Okay, a summer. This poem is called One Dawn. And I'm sure people here have experienced being up all night maybe during the summer, and kind of then the dawn has come very quickly, sometimes around 4 o'clock. And there's no darkness anymore, and if you haven't got any sleep, it's kind of a yucky feeling. And so I kind of wrote, with that in kind of mind, I wrote this poem a number of years ago called One Dawn. Here it comes, the heat slowly rising, as your cover of darkness disappears into the sharp mouth of a summer morning. At the window, you watch the all-consuming, jealous god rise above galvanized shed roofs. Brightness comes in pale blue, too late to see the morning star, which you learned somewhere does not signify beauty. So much. Okay, I'm kind of cheating a little bit with this one. It's kind of it qualifies as an autumn poem because it has September in it, in three. So I think that kind of puts it in as an autumn poem. And it's called The Emperors of St. Mary's Road. And my sister, who was here in the audience, will remember this. So we used to have a big Eucharistic procession in Galway, and around from where we lived, there's a big long road called St. Mary's Road, and there was a secondary school there with a huge field. And the Eucharistic procession for Galway City used to commence there, and it was a huge, fairly spectacular kind of affair. I'm sure you probably have something similar here in Cork. And the whole thing has kind of become very kind of minimalized now. I don't even know if it even take place in the city. But I suppose I have a lot of memories of that. And around that time, or a little bit after that time, I remember, I don't know if any of you remember the television, some of you are far too young, the television series I, Claudius. And I was
a bit young, I wasn't
allowed to. I was just about allowed to care for it. And missed my doing my homework. I was big into that series at the time, I kind of read up on all things about the Roman Empire and all that. So it's kind of juxtaposing the two kind of things, and it's I suppose the Eucharistic procession, I suppose it was kind of symbolizing the kind of decline of the power of the church, kind of, you know, and we were getting into the beginnings of their decline at that stage. Okay, the Emperors of St. Mary's Road. Nile Lodge to Cook's Corner, the longest road in town, where a declining afternoon is without end. In 79 I walked there, scepter and chalice, a 15-year-old despotic emperor of Rome. Before that, priest emperors worshipped in the fields of St. Mary's School. Each June they gathered at the hill to make love to the sun, magnificent in their gold-embroidered vestments, chanting, "Glory to God in the highest." From this sanctified point, which reeked of cider and pit, they commenced the city's Eucharistic procession, placing the precious host in the monstrance, raising it up to the sky, then towards Shantala, Taylor's Hill, finally to the central multitudes of Santa cans, ice caramels, toffees, and indifferent bags of crisps that somehow sensed the slow and peculiar death of an empire. In 82, I walked there, a September Friday night, returning pissed from the Lenevoy disco, the 18-year-old now neither emperor or poet, but a mere observer of the one true supremacy on St. Mary's Road, the tree. Looking up at the leaves, then with a quick deflection over the roofs of the modestly incomed stiff upper-lipped houses, to see the conic laundry spire, laundry pipe and the jet spire, below the rectangular garden lined with autumn dew. I looked back to the Clatter Palace, the mythical way out to Salt Hill. Knowledge gained in St. Mary's Road, emperors in their winter fortress, would forever their back at the unconquered summer. And this is Winter, kind of written a few years ago, kind of about, it's entitled Vampire. The vampire, I think, fascinates me, a mythical creature. Like, what fascinates me is the fact that they supposedly can't die, and they continue living, like I've done that for many, I suppose loads of you have seen the film Interview with a Vampire, where Brad Pitt goes on to continues to live, and they can't kind of exist during the day, and he goes to a cinema to see his sunrise. And that theme has always kind of fascinated me, with darkness and light, and kind of, and I think the vampire is probably a bit more of a complex creature than the Hollywood kind of film would sometimes portray. Vampire, grimacing behind the curtain, shielding from the sunlight. Those tortured eyes fear the ugly shine to the skin and imminent decomposition. Squatting under the rafters, watching the centuries expire, no longer interested or threatened by Bibles, crucifixes, or the relics of life-ridden saints. sustenance is not gained from the drinking of opulent blood at the Black Shrine. The undead exists by inhaling the vapours from a heartbreaking past. Between the rooms it waits. Passages of sleep are interspersed with the closing of doors that will never reopen. The minutes are drained of continuation. Through a crack in the wall, the slant of evening becomes visible. As a loosened mist forms above the hill. Soon, this creature will have its liberation when it reunites with the possibility of a winter's night. Okay, another performance poem. Last year, before Gordon Brown became Prime Minister of Britain, he had kind of tried to reach out to the youth of Britain, you know, and try to show like that he was kind of basically a kind of a cool guy. And, you know, he it didn't kind of go so well. So he cited like that he liked the Arctic Monkeys, and it really didn't go very well. Gordon kind of got into a bit of difficulty, and I think he hasn't been kind of out of those difficulties since. And this poem is called The Truth, the British Prime Minister, and the Band. The Right Honourable Gordon Brown MP is the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom of England, Scotland and Northern Ireland. Before he moved to number 10, he spoke to the British people and said, I like the Arctic Monkeys. What did he say? I like the Arctic Monkeys. You see, the soon-to-be British Prime Minister had been speaking freely about life and things and saying, my father instilled in me values that are deeper than values. But when I went to university, it was an opportunity to let my hair down a little and explore other aspects of existence, such as music. Back then, I was into Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin. However, I tremendously admire today's young musicians. For instance, I like the Arctic Monkeys. And so came the day at summer day at Buckingham Palace, when Gordon was on his knees before Queen Elizabeth II. She looked down upon him and asked, Mr. Brown, are you in a position to form my government? He replied, Your beloved Majesty, I like the Arctic Monkeys. Later at Crawford Ranch, Texas, George W. told him, Gordon, you're a heck of a guy, and we can work together on Iran, Iraq, Iceland, or wherever I may next before I'm lost. He replied, Mr. President, I like the Arctic Monkeys. At the European summit, he bumped into his neighbour, Bertie, who told him, I garden, come let the fuckers get you. You know, just heading one thing one day and another thing another day, so half the time I don't know what I'm doing. He replied, your t-shirtness. I like the artist. But not everybody was happy with this. While sipping his lemon tea, at number 10 Downing Street, he was pulled into the back of a cupboard by New Labour's backroom team. They said, Gordon, what were you thinking of? Arctic Monkeys, Jesus be Christ. You're not, Tony, and you never will be. Then he said, but I like the Arctic Monkeys. I really do though. I like their song, I bet you look good on the dance floor. Their reply was swift. Shut up, Gordon, and do as we tell you. So soon the situation was in hand when the Prime Minister rectified, when he clarified to Jeremy Paxman on the BBC, who asked, so Prime Minister, what did you exactly say about the Arctic Monkeys? Gordon paused. Then, well, the truth is, Jeremy, I probably know more about the Arctic Circle than the Arctic Monkeys. So, there you have it. You can't make a monkey out of Gordon. Well, at least not an Arctic monkey, anyway. Thank you.
Okay, after that.
Okay, these poems are a kind of general mix, I suppose, of sort of place and person and different. This poem is called Temple, and it's about, I live in the east side of Galway City, and there's a beach called Ballylahon Beach, which I sometimes go down to. It's kind of a way to get away from the kind of the stresses of everyday life. And it's not a very kind of glamorous beach, like, you know, it's not full of lovely golden, it's not a golden sand or anything like that, but it's still a nice place. It's not a great beach to swim in, though. Anyway, this I wrote this one winter's night, actually, just after being down there. It's called Temple. Talk about a different approach to a shrine. With broken pipes and inky cold mud, Ballylahon Beach has no golden master, dispensing either peace or the scent of the damned on this December night. No celestial beautiful mind, just me belted into the middle-aged car, long ludicrous green scarfs, scrawling disconnected notes, while outside a wide stage of rain and sucking wind. Bent on vengeance, a stench escapes from the rocks. I stay in the car. Instead, spy containers, maybe cranes out on Mutton Island. For dramatic effect, I hope that a night boat sails out from Galway docks. Over at Mellow's hurling pitch, the floodlights have just been reduced. A copper sky hangs over the bay as the rats dodge bullets of light moving eternally through the seaweed. Down on the grass margin, other seasonal cars are parked. The definite moans of various boiling kettles. Ballylahon winter, not a lush, transcendent pine forest, but still, the scenery is unbeatable. This is my temple. Okay, and this is again about an area that's not too far from where I live in, and it's called the Zone of Grey Occupation. The Zone of Grey Occupation lies halfway from limbo to nothing in particular. It was created one deathly Tuesday afternoon during a conversation between a town clerk and a chief engineer. Walk across it, but you will soon find out that there is no point to eternity. At first glance, life is not too bad, might be planted in its grass. But comes the edge of the road that leads to a dead garage. Here houses achieve fusion with the backdrop. Every evening they implode to a fraction of why anything should mean something in a swollen universe. But in the end, the question will be, who murders the garage in the Zone of Grey Occupation? And this one is called Euro Changeover, which, as you might guess, I wrote at the time that Ireland changed to the Euro in January of 2002, and this actually is based on something that happened in the supermarket that we use just down the road from us. Euro Changeover. A woman went up to the checkout with a trolley full of dog food and white bread. Hanging from the ceilings were the sign that proclaimed the dawn of the Euro. Putting her hand deep inside a denim jacket around her critical mass, eventually producing £150. A young assistant manager tapped her lightly on the shoulder, pointing to the boot inside the door where she could exchange the lethargic points for the exciting new currency. Unconvinced by this common sense, she looked around at all of us in the queue as if we could somehow give the necessary lies. Silence from the blonde on the till with the indifferent green fingernails made her for the very first time realize something. Now she knew there was no cells in the body or a soul in transit. All our currency to be traded, valued and devalued, and gradually phased out. this poem is called 3:30 a.m. because I wrote this by asking goes over to my friend, and he used to live on the other side of town, and sometimes he used to return late. And sometimes the town is kind of a strange atmosphere of the town when everything is kind of empty. And if it's not, unlike tonight, if it's a dry night and with all the kind of new buildings, and it's kind of a very strange and different place to what I remember when I was growing up. 3:30 a.m. I am driving home through the centre of this 3:30 a.m. town, returning from a friend. We have just shut down the world. The night is dry, the long street is antiseptically clean and free of utterances. Pristine blue apartments resonate lighting with film studio precision. My car is playing organ music. I decelerate speed halfway down this rectangle while pumping the volume to an active frenzy. Who inhabits this perfect little dimension? I speculate and turn off for the docks. The radio crumbles to a dead frequency. And then this poem is called Contact, and I suppose it's about kind of the role of the theme of kind of looking for extraterrestrial life, and and given the magnitude and distances in space, that seems to be extremely remote, but I suppose people romanticize about it. And it's called Contact. I gaze for comets and omens, all apparent in the nightshade. The castles built on the clouds, those ships that form the armada which close in on the moon. My eye captures the star that is 1,000 light years, omitting radiation, splitting particles, filtering through history, touching this unremitting daytime. I spend my given hours charting its course across the meridian, convinced of its oceans, its civilizations of knowledge, and vast continents of freedom. But does it turn its powerful observatories on me, mapping another presence in its cosmos, when all that I am doing is showing it the death of cities? And this poem is called Velvet Rim. It's about sort of a wine bar we used to kind of frequent in Galway that is now a Japanese restaurant. And we used to have good nights. We used to have actually readings in there, and it was kind of the start of a lot of the scene in Galway. And anyway, this is called Velvet Rim. Before we entered this subtle box of a wine bar, evening was already beautifully lethal. Mints and black roses as the gathering increased. A hill of coats tossed on a chair, sparkling glasses on the counter. Sweet red gossip captures every tendril of the table. Plates of chocolate cake and dubious free verse. Every breath, every vignette, climbs into high art or something else. The hours fall like velvet bleeding men in the trenches. Across the street, a dry, elegant breeze sways the shopfront lantern. Wax drips on to the tablecloth. Crazy talk of rope and dandelions, things that would invariably change back to air. As the velvet comes up to the rim of the glass, the minute is ripped by the coffee machine. Sympathetic angel voices sing the fretful song, their golden hair ready to detonate from way above. The evening disappeared and could never again be located. The truth is that before they disappear, all evenings first become pale flesh to the mask, and then to the dance that concludes in farce or solitude. But maybe, hiding down some velvet stream, is a perfect night of lanterns, where symbols cease to represent, and sweetness is the hour. I'm sure people here have been to weddings. You might have been to a few. And I've been to a few weddings, and this is just actually, I just saw some photographs a few years ago, and kind of and looking back, a lot of time had elapsed, and did relationships change, I think, in those years, and it's kind of just kind of strange looking at pictures and the people, the different people as where they are now. Wedding shots. Last night, a bundle of wedding shots stumbled onto the floor. With incredulity, I picked them up, wondering, who were the people? Why was I there? A decade has passed, those faces remain frozen without explanation. Strange to have taken part in somebody else's intensity, to stare at an acquaintance unknown to me. Vividly, I can recall the perfume, the red and white dresses, looking away from the camera's deceit. Like a classified file, the wedding shots were put in a drawer, to be unrecognized from a future date.
Okay,
but these poems are kind of, I suppose, broadly speaking, kind of post-war and World War II kind of poems. And this first poem is called Our Weimar Republic. And the period of the Weimar Republic was, you know, the period after the First World War, in between the First World War and the rise of Hitler. And obviously Germany was gone through a fairly severe kind of crisis at that time. And in that time, things kind of stabilized for a while, and then you had the Wall Street crash in 1929 and the acceleration of the Nazis. And people were wondering kind of what ways they could, that Hitler might be stopped. And I mean, and as a sign of how pathetic things were, in the presidential election of 1932, the ancient General Hindenburg was the president. Bet Hitler in the presidential election, and people thought Hitler is going to be stopped. You know, we've put a stop to him. And even though Hindenburg was an extreme reactionary as well, and I think people were grasping at straws. And I think often, I suppose, people do that, and kind of people look for some sort of, and pretend and delude to themselves that, you know, things could be better. You know, that they've staved off the worst. But I think that obviously this was sadly wrong. Our Weimar Republic. Do you remember the blessed night when old Hindenburg bet Hitler? We were all going to be saved, our Weimar Republic secure. We would now travel the road to perfection and enlightenment. Summer brings its own cruelty, the day of the banquet not forgotten. You made a speech for an empress. On a bus to a beaten path, envying the young September couple, wanting each other's flesh but constrained by rumours of a new world order. I think of her lips, his stubble, my silent ranting absorbed by the orchestra's reprisal. Will the tomorrows judge back in hatred? Maybe not in hatred, just a slow type of pity. At the end of the night, we took our champagne on to the balcony, whispering, Hindenburg has beaten Hitler. Our little Weimar Republic is saved. All the Jews, all the Slavs, all the gays, all the communists, all the liberals are all saved. You and I are saved. Just look up at the green, dark sky. And this poem, I suppose, I wrote this poem, it's called Icy Air, and I don't know if any of you have seen the film The Pawnbroker with Rod Steiger, a film made in the 1960s of a survivor of a concentration camp. And this poem has tried to kind of capture some of that. I think it's one of the probably best films that are made about that period. Icy Air. The icy air dries all in its path, comes like an arrow down from the hill, cuts through the crawling forest, maneuvers around the foul lake, penetrates a ripped net, climbs a brick mound, drives across the caked earth, races for the shed, sneaks in the broken window to a cement cover, and grins at blood around the toilet. And the next poem, the last in the war poems, is the poem called Little Man Little Boy. And Little Boy was the name of the atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. And the man who authorized that was Harry Truman. And Truman didn't learn about the existence of the atomic bomb until the day he became president, when Franklin D. Roosevelt died. And at the first meeting of the government, he was told by the Secretary of Defense, or the Secretary of War, about the existence of the atomic bomb. And it's just, I think obviously that was a fairly poignant moment in world history. In 1945, the war on the Earth planet coughed onwards and upwards to its last bloody voice, singing out, "Victory! With us and the end of time." Soviet troops had crossed the Elbe, the Danube, and the Oder. Lancaster bombers dropped their incendiary payloads over the darkened cities of the Reich. Hitler groped for his final bottle of Valium. Meanwhile, in the softly lit spring night of Washington, D.C., distinguished white heads, impeccable grey suit, sat around the table for the first time with the new president, the little man from Independence, Missouri, talking of triumph, reconstruction, and spheres of influence. One by one, they discussed, when the meeting concluded, they discussed their son's last year in Harvard and a wife's orphan charity. One by one, they left the room till the president saw only the Secretary of War. Coming across from the other end of the table, he sat next to the little man from Independence, Missouri. "Mr. President, I have something to tell you, something of the utmost importance, something deep that cuts through philosophy. Mr. President, we have it. It is superiority. It is all the sunrises put together. And we never could dream of the moment would come when we would roar louder than God." The lights flickered, the portraits on the wall stared down in dread, but the Honorable Secretary of War did not dim. "Mr. President, it will have more power over men than Betty Grable's legs. This is the biggest thing in history, and you can quote me on that." The little man from Independence, Missouri, took the pen in his hand, and looking up to the almighty ceiling, whispered, "Victory, with us, and the end of time." Okay, there's just the last few poems here. These are more recent ones. This poem is called Later On, and it's again a bit about a friendship that has kind of changed. "Later on, I envied your black leather jacket, and even its successor, the lumberjack fleece. On a Sunday evening in February 1983, you ordered a burger in a bar. To me, this was the revolution. The dingy flats were impressively Dostoevsky. Here with books and cakes, you dreamt of a stateless future. Intelligence came with an ease that made your voice so very collected. Never the gossiping dilettante, witty remarks were always strategic. If there were courses in being you, how it applied. Today the world is exploding, armed with rocks of common sense. Your passion now burns like a five-watt bulb." The poem is sixth class, and the teacher we had in sixth class had a big thing for adults. "With your permanent smirk, you stood at the back blackboard, weighing up the hilarity of life. Were you a fun guy? No, you were just brilliant. A mastermind, I would say. Then the boy with the butter stains in his copy, you got him, then exposed him to give the savage little arena another freak. Like a clever prosecutor, you held up the evidence, and I watched you reduce the testimony of the guilty to babble. Unlike my fourth class Himmler, you had no desire for black celibate canes. Verbal methods were more complete in your sardonic principality of Kato boxes and orange amplifiers. Could I ever forget those ABBA afternoons? You had the words typed up for all the class to sing on a joyous Tuesday in the Lent of 1976. Oh, can't you hear me, darling, can't you hear me, SOS, would travel out into the corridors, over to the freezing toilets, without the number 13 cubicle. You probably now say, never mind that vocation, bullshit. At that age, I never heard of feminism, but I thank you for teaching me about the hilarity of life. Okay, just one more poem. This poem is called, again, kind of returning to a kind of a space theme. It's called 39 AU, and it's about Pluto. And my son is kind of fascinated by that, because there's a probe on its way to Pluto that will reach there in 2015, just before his 17th birthday. And it's a big interest for him. So this poem a few years ago, and this is the last poem. So I just again like to thank Paul and Jean for having me here tonight. It's been great here to read in Cork. Okay, 39 AU. Here at 39 AU, the noonday sun is a distant headlight. Temperature minus 205 Celsius. Giant boulders engender thin lines on a sullish plain. Frozen crystals of methane and ammonia are sparkling as pools of liquid hydrogen remain motionless. Pluto knows only the cold of 39 AU. The cold will never depart and never betray. The planetary surface is mute and constant, but beneath the rocky core of solidified minerals is there memory. A memory of something close, minutes of a May dusk in a bedroom, children's voices merging with a red horizon. Now Pluto's noon sky is filled with a million galaxies. Here at 39 AU, there can only be truth. Thank you very, very much.